This recording is for institutional communication use only. The views expressed represent an assessment of market conditions at a specific point in time or opinions only and should not be relied upon as investment advice regarding a particular investment or markets in general. Such information does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell specific securities or investment vehicles. It should not be assumed that any investment will be profitable or will equal the performance of the portfolios or any securities or any sectors mentioned herein. An investor should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund carefully before investing. To obtain a prospectus containing this and other information, please call 212-259-0430 or download the file from www.exoticfunds.com. Please read the prospectus carefully before you invest. Past performance does not guarantee future results. Investment returns and principal value of the fund will fluctuate so that shares may be worth more or less than their original cost. Current performance may be higher or lower than the performance data quoted above. For current performance information, please call 816-843-7623. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. The fund is newly organized with limited operating history. The fund is classified as a non-diversified under the 1940 Act. A non-diversified fund is not limited by the 1940 Act with regard to the percentage of its assets that may be invested in the securities of a single issuer. Consequently, the securities of a particular issuer or a small number of issuers may constitute a significant portion of the fund's investment portfolio. Alps Distributors Incorporated is the distributor of the Exotic Strategic Income Fund. Exotic Capital LLC and Alps Distributors are not affiliated. Alps Distributors Incorporated is not affiliated with Exotic Funds, SkyPoint Capital Partners, or Compass Distributors. SkyPoint Capital Partners LLC serves as the wholesale marketing agent for Exotic Funds.
Greetings and welcome to the Exotic Strategic Income Fund third quarter investor call. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded today, Tuesday, October 27, 2020. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Brian Smith. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. My name is Brian Smith, CEO of SkyPoint Capital. Our speakers today will be Exotic founder and CIO Clay DiGiacinto and partner and co-head of credit Matt Weinstein. Our objectives for today's call are first to give you a clear understanding of the opportunities in structured credit, both now and but also opportunities that may emerge in the future given the uncertainties with the COVID-19 pandemic, the upcoming presidential election, and the current state of both the U.S. and global economies. Our second goal is to give you insight on the current positioning of the Strategic Income Fund, which we believe to be defensive, diversified, and differentiated from its peer group. And now for our speakers. Prior to forming Exotic, Clay was the head of mortgage trading for Tower Research Capital from December 2008 through December 2010. From July 2010 through March 2008, he was a vice president in the Fixed Income Currency and Commodities Group at Goldman Sachs and Company, with responsibility for the hybrid and adjustable rate mortgage trading business. Clay received his MBA in finance and statistics from the Wharton School of Business. He served as a captain in the U.S. Army in the 25th Infantry Division from 1995 to 2000 and received a BS in mechanical engineering from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Matt Weinstein joined the firm in 2012 and is responsible for trading and portfolio management across the Exotic's credit businesses. Prior to joining Exotic, Mr. Weinstein was a vice president at Macquarie Capital, where he manages CMBS principal investment strategy from 2010 through 2012. From 2003 to 2008, Matt was an associate director in the CMBS group at Bear Stearns. Matt received his MBA in finance at New York University School of Business and graduated from Cornell University with a BS in industrial labor relations. Clay, Matt, and partner and co-head of credit Jamshed Engineer lead a team of 51 professionals and $3.5 billion in AUM. With that, I will turn the call over to Clay.
Thanks, Brian, and I appreciate everybody jumping on a call this morning for the update. I had a debate with a friend of mine the other day that runs a equity long-short fund, and what we were debating is the most interesting market to trade and invest in. So picture a Martian who's a billionaire and was trying to figure out what sort of requirements would he demand if he came to Earth and there was all of these interesting investment opportunities. What sort of market would he demand that he thought that he could make the most money in? And I sort of came up with eight points to my argument. I think he'd want an asset class with some sort of systematic tailwind, like a shortage of housing in the United States. I think he'd want the market to be over-the-counter, not exchange-traded, and an ability to execute in a bilateral fashion. I think he'd want the market to be liquid, I think that you would like the market to be dislocated, assumption-driven. I think that you want a market with numerous players with a differentiated skill set and an ability to have asymmetric informational advantage. I think you'd prefer a market that automatically de-risks, meaning it sort of turns risks into cash. And lastly, my point number eight would be, you'd love a market if it cash flowed. That is, in a nutshell, the structured credit market. So we're really excited to be participating in this market. We think it's an incredible opportunity where alpha skill sets can shine. And thank you for our current sort of investors on the fund and anybody else that's thinking about it. We'd welcome having continued dialogue. What we're trying to achieve with the Access Fund is we want to build an income-producing portfolio of bonds to generate mid-single-digit yield. That's what we thought about last year when this idea first came to be, and obviously we launched the fund in December of 2019. Because, we certainly can't time it, but we did get quite lucky when we started raising capital for this fund, which was right around that first week of April. So what we have now, instead of a portfolio of investment grade mid single digits performing assets, we have a portfolio of mid single digits yield with a significant amount of price appreciation built in, and that's we certainly didn't plan it, but I think right now the opportunity set that we've been given post March and the current opportunity set today is one where I think that's quite achievable. I'll tell you that our biggest exposures right now are CMBS. That's about 43% of the book. RMBS, which is 33%, and asset-backed securities, which represent about 16% of the book. I'll talk a little bit about RMBS and ABS, and then I'll turn it over to my partner Matt to talk through what we're seeing in our exposures on the CMBS part of the book. I think what's interesting in RMBS and one of the things that you should take away from our investment philosophy is we're really not trying to buy spread. We're not always predictors of spread. What we're trying to do is we're trying to buy cheap cash flows, and it's very important in any bond that we buy, and this has historically been the truth at our firm for the past 10 years, where we have a dogmatic approach to the cash flows. We want to make sure if we invest a dollar that we get our dollar back over some period of time, and then there's a significant continued cash flow that's basically the return on that dollar that we'll be able to see generated. So you'll rarely hear people at this firm talk about buying something at 4% yield and hoping that it tightens to 3.50 to 3.5%, because although that can happen and there are times where bonds are cheap, that's really not our DNA, is to be buyers of spread and hope or wish that it tightens. Now, I will tell you, given the post-COVID environment, there's plenty of cheap bonds out there. We like its current cash flow and return. I do think because it's cheap relative to all high yield and IG assets out there that there is some room for tightening, but that's not the bet that we're making when we invest and buy these cash flows. Specifically in RMBS, there's really a couple focuses that we have. It's most of our exposures on the legacy RMBS. That means that these are bonds that are seasoned more than 12 years. This would be pre-2008 type securities. Our two main focuses would be the call option and the forbearance trade. Let me talk about this for a second. Again, we're not trying to introduce beta to the portfolio. I think it's our job to try to build a portfolio that can express some alpha momentum. And what I mean by that is we're supposed to introduce some convexity to the portfolio, and we can do that when we find these call option bonds. Call option bonds are bonds below par. As anybody that's been in this market knows that fixed income often is run yield to worst. Yield to worst for discount bonds would be yield to maturity. But there is a nuance in all of these legacy securities where the servicer or special servicer has a right but not the obligation to effectively collapse the deal. And what that means is that they can pay par for all the bonds and then receive or unwind the trust and receive all of the loans. And they'll do that if a couple things are true. Number one, if the portfolio of underlying loans is worth more than par, it would be efficient for them to do it. Number two, if the collateral factor or the collateral factor on the deal is less than 10%, they have the right to be able to do it. We've built a portfolio of these in our LP funds. Quite frankly, we liked them at 80. We liked a lot of these bonds at 80. We like them a lot more at 60 or 70. And we've been able to buy some of these types of what we call our call option bonds into the Axis Fund. And what it gives us is a pretty stable cash flow profile or yield profile while we wait for the servicer to call the collateral. When you own these assets at 70 cents on the dollar, you can imagine that there should be some pull to par over time. But really, we have a framework where we think that it can be called or collapsed by the servicer sometime in the next 2 to 4 years at par, and that's really that upside convexity that we're trying to build into the book with these types of bonds. The second big exposure on the legacy RMBS side are our forbearance. We have them tagged as forbearance trades. And effectively what this is if you recall, after the last global financial crisis, there was a tremendous amount of forbearance. The government came out and rightfully said, hey listen, the issue is not necessarily housing prices. The issue is the cost of housing. See, we have this theory that you can't really be short housing unless you can convince your spouse that you're supposed to pitch a tent in the park. You have to be long housing, and you're either long it through a mortgage payment or a rental payment. Either way, there's some sort of payment where you're going to have a roof over your head. What happened 10 or 12 years ago when the government came out with these forbearance programs, they effectively said to all delinquent borrowers, hey, we see you're delinquent. We see that your payment's too high. What we'll do is we will forbore some portion of your principal, a $200,000 house. Maybe they would forbear $40,000 to get the mortgage balance down to $160,000. They would capitalize all of the deferred interest and principal. That would be the new balance that the payment rate would be made from. And that was a very successful program. You saw a lot of folks who were delinquent become current. They've since been current for 10 or 12 years. It's now 2020. These borrowers have since been current. That's been part of the rules for the forbearance program. But now there's a lot of home price appreciation built into these homes. And what happens is when the homeowner sells the home, they first have to pay back the $160,000. That's their new principal. The next $40,000 is actually due to the trust. The reason why this was a forbearance program and not a forgiveness program was specifically around forgiveness would have caused a tax liability for that specific homeowner. So this was a forbearance program. The next $40,000 goes to the trust, and then any upside post that original $200,000 mortgage amount is due or would be upside for the homeowner. This is a hyper niche program. We've developed technology over the past 4 years to be able to decipher within the 30,000 RMBS QSIPs and the several thousand RMBS trusts which trusts we think have more forbearance principal outstanding than not. This is not a data point or a number that Bloomberg will give you. This is not a data point or number that any off-the-shelf program will give you. We actually have to solve for it, and we've done this for all of the RMBS trusts out there to give us an inclination which deals we think have a higher probability of collecting forbearance recovery versus not. So what does this mean? This means that we have a handful of bonds, both the call option and the forbearance bonds, that we own subpar, call it, you know, average dollar price of 80 cents on the dollar, that the base case, the standard case, is that you get a mid-single digits type yield profile. The upside case, or that convexity, that gamma that we're trying to build into the book, are these things which would be a call option, or the forbearance would be additional cash flow distributed to the trust. And we try to find bonds that are positioned to receive some of that cash flow. That's really the upside. I'll tell you, we bought, you know, during the crisis, I would say in April and May, we did allocate some to non-QM IG, triple Bs and single As. We've since sold most of them. I'll tell you the reason why is not because we think that there's necessarily dark storms on the horizons, but really it just doesn't make that much sense to own. When we can own these bonds at a spread and a yield and a cash flow profile that makes sense, we're supposed to own them. When there's not a lot of upside built in to the portfolio, we'll sell them. And I have a number that I think you'll find pretty interesting. The portfolio right now is around $640 million. We have purchased, the AUM is $640 million. Since inception, we've bought a current face of $825 million of bonds that represents a market value of $591 million. So our average purchase price has been 72 on the portfolio since inception, and most of those purchases were post April. Our average sale, and this is what one of the things that I do think differentiates us from the peer set, is our thoughtful surveillance and maintenance process. Our average sale, and we've sold $100 million of securities, which represents a current face of $96 million. So our average sale since inception has been at $103. And the average price of our portfolio right now is in the low 80s. I think at this point in time, I'm going to turn it over to Matt to talk a little bit more about our CMBS exposure. Afterwards, I'll come back. I'll talk about some risks inherent to the portfolio. I'll highlight more our surveillance and maintenance process, and then sort of talk about what we see on the horizon. Matt?
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Clay. You know, first off, I just want to start off by acknowledging that, you know, my market, the CMBS market, is, you know, undoubtedly one of the more misunderstood and probably overreported parts of the market, and we think that's why the opportunities are going to be pronounced. You know, I walked in today. I'll read you two headlines that came across my inbox before 4-8 a.m. this morning. One was CMBS, the elephant in the room no one wants to talk about. That was from a leading Wall Street strategist. The other one was a Wall Street Journal article. The title is "Struggling Rental Market Could Usher in Next American Housing Crisis." So clearly, there's a lot of buzz out there, and every day a new article, you know, seems to hit the press. We think this creates a huge opportunity. Investors want to loop CMBS into this one sort of big, scary, ominous category. We think doing so is going to miss a huge opportunity today and a huge opportunity over the next few years. Here's some context. You have approximately $400 billion CMBS market. 10% or so is already in default and coming due between now and the end of 2021 of non-defaulted CMBS loans is another $40 billion. Of that $40 billion, about 50% is in retail and office. So you have about $20 billion of retail and hotel conduit CMBS loans coming due by the end of 2021. If you look at this backdrop, this is not a backdrop for people without real credit expertise. It's for investors with deep credit and deep CMBS experience. There are a couple types of investors in the CMBS asset class. There are those who look at it as relative value. They look at the bond on spread, something Clay talked about. Those investors often miss the embedded CRE risk. There's the CRE investors who look at the underlying commercial real estate, but often fail to miss the nuances of the bond structure and the legal and government documentations that talk about what happens when loans go bad, what happened when the loans default, and loans do default. At Exonic, we build a team that has expertise in all these areas. We layer a legal and structural framework on top of the deep credit analysis of both the underlying properties and the underlying loans. Are there areas of meaningful concern within commercial real estate and CMBS? Of course. Were these trends already in place before March and before COVID? Absolutely. What COVID did was shorten how quickly these trends played out. It didn't create these trends. Hotels were already battling a glut of supply, demand threats from Airbnb, and room rate pressure in many markets across the country. Likewise, the shift from brick and mortar to online retail sales began well before March of 2020. At Exonic, we've been bearish on retail and hotel for a few years now. The vast majority of CMBS loans that have gone into default are hotel and retail. Many received forbearance. We've seen estimates as high as $20 billion of loans currently in forbearance. Well, we're sitting here with Q4 coming up, Q1 of 21, and that forbearance period is about to end. The fundamental shock that's occurring on the ground at the property level is going to play through to the CMBS debt. It's going to lead to more rating agency downgrades, and it's going to lead to some pain for hotel and retail CMBS. But not every hotel is the same. The story is a lot more nuanced. Leisure travel has recovered faster than corporate. Limited service hotels have recovered faster than luxury. If you look by markets, you've seen some markets in this country, like Boston, where revenue at hotels year-to-date is down 70%. There's other markets where revenue to date is down 15 to 20%. Many hotels have been shut since March. Many will never reopen. But over the medium and long term, this means there's going to be a material drop in supply. As demand rebounds, this is very bullish for those hotels that survive. My point is hotels are challenged, some far more than others. Our job at Exonic is to find the outperformers. We find the hotels and shopping centers that we think will survive, we think will ultimately thrive, and we try to purchase them and purchase the bonds that they back at valuations that reflect the hotel and retail assets that are going to be demolished. I just want to reiterate that point. I think it's powerful. My point is we're going to buy assets that are going to thrive, and we're going to buy them at valuations reflecting those that are going to go out of business. That's the CMBS market. We remain patiently on the sidelines for hotel and retail credit. We think a huge buying opportunity is coming in 2021. We've also avoided conduit CMBS. The average conduit CMBS deal has about 40 or 50 loans, some of which are the aforementioned retail and hotel assets. As a credit buyer, and we are deep credit buyers, we do a deep amount of credit work and underwriting due diligence. In a CMBS deal, you get no benefit from the best 30 or 40 loans being money good. Those loans could be worth par, they could theoretically be worth 110. It doesn't matter if you're buying anything below the AAA. Your risk and your return is to those worst 5 to 10 loans. Trying to underwrite and form a true credit view on 50 loans that mature in 10 years with hundreds of underlying tenants that may or may not renew in advance of the 10-year maturity, that's really hard to do. There's a price we care for conduit CMBS, but we've never felt swaps plus 400, for example, is the right price for conduit triple B minus. We just don't think it's anywhere near the right risk-adjusted return for the asset class. These are deep credit bonds. They should be valued off fundamental recovery, not some relative spread. Again, something that Clay touched on earlier. So given that backdrop, what are we buying? You know, as Clay said, we're about 45% allocated to CMBS. Despite our negative bias on certain types of CMBS, it's our largest allocation. We've deployed our investors' capital into two key segments of the market, single asset, single borrower, or SASB deals, and multifamily Freddie Mac Mezz. Unlike in condo at CMBS, in a SASB deal, you only need a form of credit view on one asset or one portfolio of like assets and to one borrower. SASB loans are typically 2 to 5 year loans, and in 5 years versus in 10 years, a lot less bad, think tenant bankruptcies, tenants not renewing, can happen than in 10 years. We feel great about forming a view on a single Class A office in New York City, for example. Often we'll know the borrower. We can look at individual tenants. We can comp similar properties. We can comp market rents. We can comp tenant improvement and leasing costs. We can look at market vacancies. That allows us to come up with a true credit opinion on an individual asset. You simply can't do that on a pool of 50 diversified assets like you can in condo at CMBS. Likewise, while Freddie Mac might have a large loan count, there's no retail, there's no hotel, there's no office leases. Our relationship as a firm goes back with Freddie Mac to 2014. We purchased well in excess of $1 billion of Freddie Mac credit securities at this point, and we take huge comfort in Freddie's disciplined underwriting standards. Our mezz securities are backed by senior mortgages on Freddie Mac multifamily debt. This means we have ample buffer from a valuation standpoint, we have ample buffer from a cash flow standpoint, and we have additional layer of protection from a bond-level credit enhancement. The fundamental backdrop for multifamily in this country was strong headed into March and remains strong today despite some of the sound bites and headlines out there, like the one we saw this morning. Underlying rent collections in multifamily assets, tracked by the National Multifamily Housing Council, have been north of 94%. The last few months, they were only down 1% year over year. 1% year over year. You're basically seeing flat rent collections October of 2020 to October of 2019. We are seeing some pressure in Class A product, particularly in dense urban infill locations. But as mentioned, we take this into account when coming up with our credit view. It's taken into account when you underwrite an asset. We're also very excited about the small balance multifamily Freddie Mac exposure within the fund. This is a sector Exonic has been overweight for years and is a growing exposure for the daily fund. Class B and C multifamily, which is the collateral for these loans, has actually seen positive net leasing and positive rent growth post-COVID, as the demand for more affordable housing options has increased as a result of the economic downturn. At that point, I will open it up to the broader group for questions. Actually, I'll turn it back over to Clyde.
Let me just comment a couple more minutes on our surveillance and maintenance process. I do think it's interesting how we hear about or see out there marketed so many what I call buy it and forget it funds. These are funds that buy bonds at new issue or in the secondary market, and they have a process that they put in the portfolio, and then they move on to the next bond that they're going to buy. One of the things that I think and certainly hope differentiates Exonic is we have a very robust surveillance and maintenance process. But let me tell you what that is. Every month, we get new data on the underlying pool of assets that back specific securitization trusts. Our work is at the core asset level. The loan level detail is what helps inform our opinion and our profile of forward prepayments, forward defaults, and forward recoveries. Every month we get new data. A few of the loans have paid off at par. A few of the loans may have defaulted. We may be at a different relative position in the capital structure because of the nuanced pay rules associated with securitization. But more importantly, we're at a different price. And so we have a process by which we can re-underwrite all of the securities, reformulate our opinion of buy, sell, or hold. And that's what informs our buy and our sell decisions. I mentioned before, in our short history, we've already sold $100 million of bonds out of this portfolio at a weighted average dollar price at 103. We certainly have no premonition that it's going to go down to 95 or 90 or even par. I guess we do know over time it's going to pay off at par. But what we're looking for is when we think about our upside and our downside or the convexity associated with certain bonds, they may make a lot of sense to buy at 97. They don't make much sense to hold at 103. And so it's this robust surveillance and maintenance process that really informs our decisioning around that. I'll mention a couple other things. Political risk. We have an election next weekend. I just saw today that 35-8 has Biden winning by 87%. We're not macro investors. We try to buy bonds that have stable profile of cash flows, no matter what the outcome is. I will tell you, as I'm sure all of you have read, that we would expect higher taxes. We would expect some sort of wealth redistribution to the lower 20% or bottom 40% of income or wealth in the country. One of the things that I think we could see is with all of the government spending, I think we could see some inflationary pressure. In general, fixed income is not great for higher rates. But at the same time, we're not taking a lot of exposure to the risk-free rate. We're taking exposure to the underlying portfolio of assets behind all these securitization trusts. And I'll tell you that when we run our loss and our default and our prepayment profiles, in general, most of those look better with higher asset prices. But we're not positioned one way or the other coming into the election. The thing that keeps me up at night the most is not the cash flow. I feel really good about that. In fact, that's what allows me to sleep at night, because I know we're so dogmatic in thinking about the loan level analysis and often being right about our default, prepayment, and recovery scenarios. The thing that keeps me up at night is managing the liquidity. And I think where I get comfort here is we're generally invested in the part of the capital structure where assets are highly saleable. They're generally in demand from long-only insurance companies, other money managers that just have dollars to put to work, that are really focused on growth. We think that we can sell into those should we ever need to. We also have a portfolio of deleveraging assets. Every month, some of our risk turns into cash, which is a really good feeling to be in. It happens around the 25th of every month, which is the remittance cycle, where our bonds pay down and we get cash. Right now, we're running about 18% cash to the portfolio. We're going to keep some of that back, for cash reserves. But we also have a healthy amount of cash for all of these investment opportunities on the horizon that we do expect. I'll tell you, we've been better sellers than buyers over the past few weeks, and again, there's not a lot of upside to owning bonds at 103. So if we can sell it now at par, we're going to do that and be ready when we're presented with buying opportunities, much lower dollar price in the 90s or even the 80s or even the 70s. And the last thing that I'd leave you with, and this has been something that we've talked about before, but it gives me a lot of comfort. We're not in the asset raising game in this fund. I think we've already communicated that we have intent in capping the fund AUM at $2 billion. We don't need to grow the fund to be profitable. We have plenty of profitable businesses aside from this fund. We're focused on delivering a return that's acceptable for our investors, and we feel good about capping the fund to be able to do that over the long term. I guess I'll end there. Hopefully we can open it up to questions, unless, Brian, you have any additional remarks.
No, let's, operator, please open the lines for questions.
The first question comes from the line of Hassan Faiz. Please go ahead.
This is Hassan Faiz from Morton Capital. Clay and Matt, thanks for the call. I have two questions. First of all, on the ABS, you mentioned that's about 16% of the portfolio. I know you did a Hertz deal, but what other areas in the ABS are you looking at? And then the second question is on the non-QM. I understand that the legacy right now is the history of mortgage holders. Obviously, that's more attractive. But at what point would you be more comfortable looking at the non-QM? Thank you again for the call.
Sure, that's a great question. ABS represents about 16% of the portfolio. We have been involved in a lot of auto ABS. For the most part, we've sold those. That trade has worked out well. We took part in some of the Hertz ABS deals in the low 90s and high 80s. Those have appreciated to par. We're better sellers at par. We've been allocating to Class A's and aviation ABS. For those that don't know, we have a PM, Simon Szymanski, that works for Matt and Jamshed, who his only focus is on ABS and specifically as a skill set in aviation ABS. We're at the very top part of the capital structure in deals that were done over the past 3 years. There's a couple interesting nuances in structured credit. Number one is the assets, and we're very thoughtful about knowing and understanding the profile of the assets. We have a bias towards narrow body versus large body. We have a bias towards airlines that focus on domestic travel versus international travel, et cetera. But we can also position ourselves within the securitization complex to think about where we get the most bang for our buck or which securities we can specifically buy that de-risk the position. And in the daily fund, we focus on the Class A's. These are yielding mid to high single digits yield, buying them in the low 90s. I do think it's possible that yields compress here. This is the prioritized cash flow in all of these aviation ABS deals. So we're not, although we're comfortable going down into deep credit parts of the aviation ABS sector, this is not an exposure that we're going to put in the daily fund. So we're staying high in the capital structure, aviation ABS that we think have a nice yield profile. And frankly, I do think they're too cheap in the low 90s. Your next question was, your other question was non-QM. Most of our non-QM exposure would be in the eye of the IG, sort of triple Bs to double Bs. We haven't gone down to residuals where, the defaults, our view is that in general, most non-QM forbearance numbers are into the high teens. We think the resids or some of the non-investment grade bonds out there are subject to actualized losses. It's certainly not our view that all forbearance, newer issue forbearance collateral without a lot of home equity built in come back. It's a price game. In April, we bought some that we thought were relatively cheap. We've since sold those. Again, I'm not expecting necessarily for prices to sell off again, certainly not in the dramatic fashion that they did in March. When prices come down there to a level that we think makes sense, we'll certainly add again.
All right, thank you again.
Once again, as a reminder, if you'd like to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephones. And our next question comes from the line of Tony Cox. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hey. I think the distributions so far over the past few months, it looks like it's annualizing around like 2%. Do you kind of expect it to stay around there or go up or down?
I think it'll go up. This is something that we've talked about internally. We've grown significantly. We've been putting cash to work. We still have a high cash position that we're excited to put to work and great cash flowing opportunities. I would expect that to increase over the next few months to get to that 4 or 5%.
Once again, as a reminder, if you'd like to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. And there are no further questions in the queue at this time.
Great. Thank you, everybody, for joining the call. We will circulate a replay of the call probably sometime within the next week or so. Thank you to both Clay and Matt for being speakers today. We wish everybody the very best and hope that you stay safe and look forward to speaking again with you for our fourth quarter call. Thank you very much.